This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
I paid my dues time after time. I've done my sentence, but committed no crime. And bad mistakes,
and welcome to Tag Teams back again.
Whoop! There is
Kelly Nelson here, joined as always by the reigning current champion of Brainbuster.
I forgot I was the reigning champion. That's like being like the reigning champion of like a semi-defunct like Mexican World Championship.
Yeah, you haven't been getting many bookings lately.
Yeah, I'm not a draw. I'm not the same draw that Kelly Nelson was.
Well, the promoter went out of. Yeah, I see you switched the title from me to you, and the promotion fucking sank like a stone 2 months.
What's
later.
Amazing is that I was on the most entertaining episode of Brainbuster of all time, and it was none of my doing.
Well, that was like the Flair Steamboat of Brainbusters. It was creatively awesome and entertaining, but it didn't draw flies to shit. So
really? Parv? I thought all the Parv maniacs would have watched it.
Yeah, Parv's usually a draw, but oh well. But you might get a chance to defend.
Well, I guess the recipe for success is to bring you back.
Yes. Yes,
that's rubber match, right?
Yes, that's what everyone wants to see. You and me inside a steel cage. Yeah.
We should just go modern one-on-one. The only two people to ever win Brainbuster.
Yeah. So I'll get talking to Johnny Sauer and see if I can get a match set up here. But anyway, this is Tag Teams back again. And yes,
woo, there it is.
We're back. No more lists.
No more lists.
Those are in the past.
I'm gonna do a list of best matches.
Well, that's something that hasn't been done. And yes, maybe.
Technically, Parv and Chad did, but I meant best matches of these Memphis tag team matches we watched.
Right. Well, yes. So we're back to watching matches. We are not back to the North. We're not back to the WWF.
Boo! Yeah, let's go south. We're
carpetbaggers today, heading down south from the North.
Hillary Clinton supporter, baby. The ultimate carpetbagger.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. In the States, you guys got a big decision coming up later in the year. I don't envy you. But we'll keep this politics free like wrestling should be.
Exactly.
So today we are heading to Memphis, Tennessee. One of the more famous wrestling territories ever. For my money, maybe the most entertaining wrestling television ever produced. I love Memphis wrestling. I love 80s Memphis wrestling. And that's where we are today, looking at some tag team wrestling from Memphis. So, you know, the original idea was to do a show based on the Fabulous Ones versus the Moondogs feud from 1983-1984, which is fucking awesome. But Marty suggested recently that we add a few more matches and make it like a general little sampler of early 80s Memphis tag team action. So we've added some extra stuff. We've added the new Fabulous Ones, Tommy Rich and Eddie Gilbert, the Pretty Young Things, who were... Well, he went by many different names in Memphis, but let's call him Coco Ware, just for consistency's sake, and Norvell Austin. And we've got Japanese. We have a Japanese tag team as well, featuring future stars in Japan. And yeah, so let's get right into it. We've got seven matches to look at. And just before we start looking at the matches, though, I just wanted to mention, you know, a little bit about Memphis tag team wrestling and, you know, a little bit of the history, because as far as like being a tag team territory, Memphis is one of the most notable ones. In the 60s and 70s, they were, you know, it was huge. Tag team wrestling was huge in Memphis and would be, you know, after that as well. But in the 60s and 70s in particular, it was pretty big. Other territories known for tag team wrestling would be like the Carolinas in the 60s and early 70s. The AWA was also a big tag team territory throughout its existence. But Memphis, I mean, just look at some of these names. I'll go through some names here from the 60s and 70s. Pretty big stars, some pretty fun teams. Jackie Fargo, who was one of the top legends in Memphis history, with various partners over the years, Lester Welch being the main one, was involved heavily in tag team wrestling and going to play a part in the matches that we're looking at, or at least the team, one of the teams we're looking at. There was the Medics, who were a mass team. Basically, their gimmick was that they were doctors moonlighting as evil professional wrestlers for some reason. But a very popular gimmick in the South in particular in the 60s and 70s. You had Tojo Yamamoto, a big star in Memphis wrestling, and various partners. You had the Blue Infernos. This is in the 1960s, another mass tag team. Tons of mass heel tag teams. That's like a Southern wrestling staple for sure. Here's another great one, the Mighty Yankees. There was various different versions of the Mighty Yankees. They were, you know, a mass team that would be in the South, of course, playing up that they're from the North, and of course that's easy heat right there. The original Heavenly Bodies, who were Al and Don Green, longtime mainstays in Memphis. And then into the 70s, we have the Interns, who were basically like the Medics, another mass doctor team. The Von Brauners, German heel team. Norvell Austin and Sputnik Monroe. Now, this was an interesting team. Sputnik Monroe, another huge legend in Memphis history. Maybe the guy who really got the ball rolling and making Memphis a super hot territory in the 60s, early 60s. This tag team, of course, is a mixed race team. Norvell Austin was black, Sputnik Monroe white, and it was just a heat magnet in the early 70s in Memphis. They had a catchphrase basically, and it was Sputnik Monroe would say black is beautiful, and Norvell Austin would say white is wonderful, and then they would hug. And you know, you can just imagine the fury that may have caused in some areas. Jerry Lawler, a young Jerry Lawler, teamed with a man named Jim White, and they had the Southern Tag Team titles 8 times in the early 70s. Then we have the original Hollywood Blondes, who were Buddy Roberts of future Freebirds fame, and Jerry Brown, super popular, super high-drawing tag team in the 70s. They worked in various different territories and drew money wherever they went. We also had a young Samoans tag team in the 70s, Bill Dundee, famous Memphis legend, various partners, including Jerry Lawler, of course. The Blonde Bombers in the late 70s, that was Larry Latham, the future Moondog Spot, who we're going to be looking at, and Wayne Ferris, who became the Honky Tonk Man in the 1980s. They were a great tag team in the late 70s, early 80s. And lastly, a very young Freebirds. This was Michael Hayes and Terry Gordy, pre-Buddy Roberts, when they were just, they may have been still teenagers or very, very early 20s at the time when they were working in Memphis. So, yeah, Memphis just a long, long history of tag team wrestling as we get into the 80s. And things really, you know, continued from there. And we're into like a pretty hot period for Memphis wrestling.
Right along ringside with a good group here today.
Oh, I tell you,
by golly, we got some great matches coming up.
Got some terrific action today.
Now, the first match we're going to look at is not, I don't know, calling it a match isn't really correct. It's more of an angle, and it's a hell of an angle, or a post-match brawl, I guess. On one side, we have a young Eddie Gilbert, himself just in his early 20s. And a very young Ricky Morton, who must have been in his early 20s as well. And they're going against a Japanese team, two young guys coming to America like they did back in those days to gain experience, a learning excursion. And on one side, or no, the Japanese team consists of Masafuji, who would be quite a big star later in Japan, and Atsushi Onida, who would be a huge star in the 90s, working all kinds of crazy death matches in Japan. And what happens here is basically, well, it turns into an out-of-control brawl. It was in Tupelo, Mississippi. It's known as the Tupelo Concession Stand Brawl. There was a couple previous concession stand brawls. One definitely in Tupelo, I think a couple years before this, involving Lawler and Dundee against the Blonde Bombers, which is also awesome. But this is quite the spectacle. If you've never seen it before, it's legendary. The action spills out of the ring and into the concession stand, where a brawl goes on for, it seems like, you know, like 20 minutes long. The date on this was September 4th, 1981. Marty, your thoughts on the Tupelo concession stand brawl?
Food fight!
Yeah.
You know, I've never seen an Onita match before.
I don't know if I've seen many others myself.
Yeah, he was like the hillbilly Jim. He was like a hillbilly Jim. I mean, that's just because it's not an inversion to Onita. Just haven't gotten around to watching FMW or I guess he's in All Japan too. Yeah, you know what? I don't understand why this match is listed. I understand why the match is listed as Eddie Gilbert and Ricky Morton versus Onita and Fuchi, but since all they show is the brawl, like, you know, they show the finish of the match with Tojo coming in, raking Gilbert's eyes. But, like, Tojo should get included. Like, he should get credit. Like,
right.
He was one of the big stars of the whole brawl. So, yes. Right off the bat, just want to shout out to Tojo, the human toad. Doesn't he kind of look like a toad?
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, it's like a kind of that short, stout dude.
Mm-hmm.
So Ricky Morton just goes to town with that stick, and then all of a sudden we cut to the concession stand. So my first question to you is, so they like get rid of Morton and Gilbert for like a little bit in the middle, like Eddie Marlin comes out and he's able to restrain him, and all of a sudden like Tojo's just beating up this random dude. And they never really make mention of who he is. And then this woman, who may be his wife, but might not be, just this, like, female fan type person. And Tojo kind of just slaps her a little bit. And she's kind of afraid, but she's not really selling for him. So what's going on? Do you know anything about this?
I want to say it was a promoter, or I could be wrong, though. This, I mean, as for the footage we're looking at today, this was the one I skipped. As far as watching it recently, I've seen it literally like four or five times, but it's been a few years, so some of the particular details escape me.
Yeah, that was like the first thing that stuck out to me was this woman getting like slapped around by Tojo and her like being afraid but also not selling at the same time. So I don't know. I couldn't tell if it was a work or a shoot or what the fuck
was
happening.
Well, yeah, I'm sure, of course, it was a work, but yeah. In Memphis, you know, their works were a lot more realistic than works in other territories.
Yeah. And, yeah, you know, that was the thing. I mean, I'm going to say that a lot, or say this a lot on this show, but this felt like ECW done better than ECW. You know, if you're my age, no matter what, even if Memphis did it, you know, 10 years before ECW, you know, my age, you're going to think of ECW first. But, yeah, it's just ECW done better than ECW.
Yep.
A lot of mustard.
Yes. Ah, he's covered in mustard and blood.
Yeah, it's just like blood becomes a condiment on the level of mustard. That's just like the blood and
the ultimate hot dog.
Tojo Yamamoto is the ultimate, you know, hot dog. Yeah, and their heads took a lot of abuse. Like they were just hitting each other a lot in the head with like hard objects, a lot of broomsticks, trash cans. Yeah, and you know, it felt really organic.
Yeah,
and it just felt like, you know, just like a brawl that you. You know, it felt like a real, you know, brawl.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it was mostly just, you know, they had an idea. Yeah, we're going to have a brawl in the concession stand, but I don't think they went step by step through what they were going to use and
exactly, yeah.
How they were going to use it. It was all improvised.
Yeah, it was just mayhem. It was just people kind of wailing on each other. All this, you know, people just lunge at each other and kind of just had to be ready for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very, very exciting and entertaining. I could totally see why this was like a big angle that would draw people in. You know, a great angle for, you know, for young talents like Ricky Morton and, you know, Eddie Gilbert.
Yeah.
Makes them more important.
Yeah, this is even pre, we just got into seeing Eddie Gilbert for the first time in the WWF on Titans, and that's 1982. So this even predated that. And he's, you know, super young in 1982. He's just... It's crazy how young he was, and Ricky Morton, you'd almost wouldn't recognize him at this.
Yeah, point. I know he's got trunks on instead of the long tights.
Yeah, shorter.
The only
hair.
Thing is his hair is exactly the same.
Yeah, well, it's not as long. I thought it was, you know, kind of shorter.
It was a little bit shorter, but it's got that same kind of like Ricky Morton like fluff to it.
Right. Yeah, this is amazing. I must have seen it, I don't know, the first time. It was a long time ago. It was during the early days of YouTube. And I think I just stumbled upon it that way. I don't think I was aware of it prior to that. And, you know, once you see this, you're like, oh, my God, it's like such a revelation. You compared it to ECW or saying it was, you know, ECW done better. And that is a great comparison. And I would have seen this, you know, 10 years after I first got into ECW. And I thought ECW was the shit in the 90s. But this is on another level. Just total chaos. You know, the way they film it, it's like, you know, we're just filming this because, you know, like almost for posterity's sake or whatever. Because it's not part of the show anymore. It's this out of control thing that's happening. It's almost like they need to document it for, like, you know, if the police need to look back at it later or something like that.
Lance Russell does a good job with that, saying, you know, telling the cameraman, hey, just keep shooting. We can figure out how much we can use after
that. Yeah. So it gives you that feeling of realism. It's just, yeah, it's so cool. This is, really, you know, groundbreaking wrestling production presentation. It's everybody needs to see this if you're a wrestling fan. It's really, really super cool. And then, like I said, there's others. The Lawler Dundee one with the Blonde Bombers is also really, really awesome. From a couple of years earlier. So go seek this out. It'll blow your mind. And so, yeah, that, you know, from one of the high points of Memphis tag team wrestling, or at least a moment involving tag teams, we're going to go now a few years down the road to what has become, I think in recent years, pretty well known in certain circles, definitely in the PWO circles, as being one of the all-time great tag team feuds. one of Memphis's all-time great tag team feuds, or just greatest feuds in general. It's between two tag teams that, you know, they're quite well known. The Fabulous Ones, that's Stan Lane and Steve Kern. You know, when the Fabulous Ones debuted in 1982, they basically started the trend of the blowjob babyface tag team, essentially, that would come to dominate a good part of the 1980s. And their influence would be seen with the Rock and Roll Express, the Fantastics, the Midnight Rockers, etc., for the rest of the decade. And then you have, on the other side, you have the Moondogs, who had already had a run in New York that we covered on Titans. And, yeah, by this time, you know, they'd been around for a few years. And they're more savage here, I think, than they were in New York, just almost uncontrollable at this point. And these two teams, we're going to look at four matches between the two of them from 83 and 84. And it's just crazy, fucking awesome stuff here. Some of my favorite matches, tag team or otherwise. I just love this stuff. Total chaos. So the first match we have is from April 4th, 1983, Mid-South Coliseum in Memphis, you know, the place where all the action happened every week, folks. This was a arena that could hold, I think, 11, 12,000 people. And they didn't pack it every week, but they held wrestling cards there every week for years and would draw, you know, often 8 to 10,000 on a weekly basis at its hottest points, which is just crazy that they were able to do that week after week. The TV that they were producing at this time was just incredible, super entertaining. And yeah, so here we go. April 4th, Fabs and Moondogs. This is the beginning of the feud. Basically, the impetus for this feud was that the Fabs were attacked on TV by the Moondogs, and the Moondogs tore up their coats. And this was significant because the coats had been given to them by the Fabulous One himself, Jackie Fargo, area legend, and the man who put together the Fabulous One tag team in 1982. And it was part of a gimmick where... Or an angle, sorry, where Jimmy Hart, who was the top heel manager in Memphis at the time, put together a team called the New York Dolls, which was Rick McGraw, who we've seen in New York on Titans, and the Dream Machine, what was his name? Troy Graham, I want to say?
And, yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, and anyway, their gimmick was that they wore hats, top hats, and tails, which was a Fargo thing in the 60s, back when Jackie Fargo was young. And Jackie Fargo was a legend in a legendary team with his brother, Don Fargo. And I'm actually not sure if that was his legit brother or not. Sorry, I'm Chief J historian, but I'm not a regular historian. But they were big in New York and other territories. And anyway, they were the Fabulous Fargos. So Jackie Fargo was upset that the New York Dolls were parading around in gear that him and his brother wore back in the day. So he put together a team called the Fabulous Ones to combat the New York Dolls. And so that's how the whole Fabulous Ones started. And they wore the top hat and tails thing quite often. And that's what happened. The Moondogs attacked them, ripped up the coat. This was war, basically, because they destroyed a sacred object that belonged to their mentor, Jackie Fargo. And now we have a feud, and this is the first match in this feud, April 4th, 1983, Fabs and Moondogs. Marty, take it away.
Yeah, so Lance Russell does a really good job putting over what you said, because I didn't know anything about that. And thankfully, Lance Russell was on commentary, explained it all to me, really put over the shame the Fabulous Ones felt, and having to tell Jackie Fargo what happened. Like, it wasn't the fact that they got beat up or that they were bloodied. It was, you know, the fact that, you know, they felt so bad that, you know, this happened and mm-hmm. that, you know, Fargo gave him this great gift and, you know, they treasured it so much. And these evil moon dogs, these savages, these hillbilly cavemen, you know, it, you know, destroyed it. All right, so I got a question for you, because I thought – so Lance Russell bailed me out on the backstory but did not bail me out on which Moondog is which. So he just called one the bigger Moondog and then the other was the Moondog.
Yeah, and this is funny because in the WWF they had names. They were Rex and Spot, originally Rex and King, but King was legit banned from coming back into the United States at one point.
I heard that story on Titans of Wrestling, and you can hear that story if you listen to Titans of Wrestling.
Yes. So here we have Rex and Spot, and the one they call, or the one Russell calls the bigger Moondog, is Rex. And okay. So the smaller Moondog is Spot. I don't know why they didn't use the names that they used in the WWF here, but for
whatever. So Spot's the one with the bigger beard and the longer hair.
Yes, yeah.
All right, I like him better. Like, he's my favorite of the two Moondogs.
Okay. Spot was Larry Latham from the okay. Blonde Bombers that I mentioned. And Rex, is Randy Colley, would become the original Smash in Demolition.
Right.
That lasted, like, two TV tapings. And then he became one of the Shadows, who we've looked at already. Famous.
Totally wrestler. Forget the Shadows match that we watched.
It was a great one.
So anyways, I like Larry Latham better. I think he's a little bit better at the stooging. I think he's a little bit better at the offense. I just think he's generally just a better wrestler. But I like the Moondogs gimmick a lot. Big fan of the Moondogs. So it would be, it's helpful to watch other Fabulous Ones matches first, I feel, than to just jump into the Moondogs feud.
Right.
Because if you watch the other Fabulous Ones matches, you'll see that their babyface shines are a little bit more playful. They're a little bit more fun. And here, they're all business. There's no monkeying around. Right. You know, the Fabulous Ones are an ass-kicking tag team. I think anybody who's read about the Fabulous Ones knows that about the Fabulous Ones. But if you watch the Fabulous Ones versus, like, the Pretty Young Things, and the Pretty Young Things are basically, you know, Midnight Express esque mm-hmm. and so you see them, you know, having a little bit more fun with the PYTs before they get into ass kicking mode in the comeback portion. Here you just see them go straight to the ass kicking mode, which really puts over how deadly serious this feud was. Steve Kern has like the best kick to the gut of all time.
Yeah,
doesn't he?
He like, does.
Perfect mechanics on his kick to the gut.
I agree. It's a work.
Really
of art.
Good. I am also the biggest Stan Lane mark in the history of the world.
Yes, the high and voter. Voter. You were the high voter on Stan Lane in the top 100 poll.
That's right. So this is kind of why I wanted to watch the Fabulous Ones, is to watch more sweet Stan. And I thought he was great at selling. Like, he's always coming. He's always trying to fight back. He's really peppering in those kicks and strikes. He lets you know he's there. There's no dying. The comeback doesn't come out of nowhere. He's just, you know, he's always there. And what's also great is Kern is not one to stand by on the freaking apron. He's going to come in there. He's going to lunge at the Moondogs. And yeah, we know how that happens. We know in pro wrestling what's going to happen. That's going to cause the Moondogs to have more of an advantage. But I'd rather see Kern constantly get involved there, you know, and because it just makes it seem like he's so much more invested rather than being a cheerleader on the apron. And I thought the Moondogs are like a better version of Demolition. Don't you think? Like, think about it. Like, were the Moondogs doing anything really different than Demolition in terms of clubbering offense? They were all clubbering, but it was like super energetic. Yes. It was like, you know, it was just a lot of fun. Love the headbutts. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I mean, they're different than Demolition in the sense that there's definitely a lot more stooging up front. But in terms of pure offense, mm-hmm. like they're the better offensive version of Demolition.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. They're very similar in their styles, that's for sure.
Yeah, and so anyways, Lane gets out of trouble, as we all know, or as we all would expect. Face Apparel makes the hot tag. Kern is always a great house of fire. Mm-hmm. True in any Babs match. Definitely the better offensive wrestler than Stan Lane, so I think they know their roles pretty well. And in addition to having one of the best to having the best kick in the, to the midsection of all time, he does have a really good, like, I like how he punches too. It's kind of like this like clubbing punch to the side of your head. It looks really good. Mm-hmm. So anyways, they end up falling prey to a bone shot. The Moondogs carry their big bone around. That sounded weird. Like, it's an actual like physical bone, and they hit Steve Curran. You know what I thought was really weird about this match?
What's that?
The ending, wicked flat.
Yeah.
Like no boots, just like people kind of just were like, okay. Like, and the Fabulous Ones just lost the tag team titles.
Right.
Like, everything about it was really feisty and energetic. And I don't know, the flat crowd response. Usually I don't let crowds dictate how I feel about a match, but, like, just really weird that in 1983 Memphis, that was the crowd response to that.
Yeah. I would say maybe it came too soon. Like, the ending came too soon and out of nowhere, maybe, for the fans to really...
But I kind of actually I connected with the fans when the finish happened. Like I knew the bone shot was gonna be the finish.
Yeah.
Like I wasn't there either. Like
yeah.
I wasn't ready either. Like no. I didn't really. Yeah. I kind of felt with the fans there.
Yeah. No, they took it home too early. I agree.
Yeah. You can. Yeah. That was it. I'm done talking about that.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, as we'll see with through all these matches, this starts with just an all out brawl. Right from the get-go, no pretense at wrestling really at all. I'm surprised you didn't mention Stan Lane and his super kicks, or savant kicks as it was known at the time. Is he the god of super kicks? Is he the originator?
He might be the originator, but even as the world's biggest Stan Lane mark, I do have to recognize that Chris Adams has a way better super kick
that's
than
true.
Stan Lane.
Yeah,
so.
Right. Yeah, now that you're right. I didn't think of Adams, and I should have.
Yeah.
Shame on me. He maybe was the originator. Right, because I was going to say, like, Stan Lane could be, like, the god of the super kick party for the Young Bucks.
Too sweet,
just too sweet.
Suck it.
So anyway, yeah, you pretty much covered it. This one doesn't have a ton to it. Lane facing peril, and then a great House of Fire by Curran, although it was short, and then a pretty quick finish, and like you said, deflated crowd. So, but this, you know. It's the first chapter in the feud, so it's not going to be the best match. It's not going to be the most crazy or anything. We got, you know, things escalate from here.
It was a very good match.
Like, yeah. It was
people who like match. Star ratings, I gave it 3.5. I mean, it was like very, very good. But,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a good table setter for the future, I would say. Okay. So from there, things get... you know, more heated, because the next time they come to the Mid-South Coliseum, we're going to have a stretcher match between these two teams, which is basically, no-holds-barred type brawl. And this one is, this definitely ups the ante here and makes things a lot more violent and crazy. I really love this match. Marty, what are your thoughts?
This match is one of the best tag team matches of all time. It's just incredible. It's violent. It's just like chaotic. And I don't know, just everything about it is, just seems just so dramatic. It's just incredible. People should definitely watch it. It's a little bit different. It's not that you don't try to force your opponent onto a stretcher, you know, rather you
right.
beat the opponent so lifeless that he has to be carried away in a stretcher.
Yes.
And it's just like they start and these two teams just are ripping into each other. I'm a big fan of the double stomp, and the Fabs are just like double stomping their way to victory. They're just crying, all the Moondogs. I mean, there's just no wrestling moves.
No,
it's just like
no.
You're fighting. You know, it's just like so visceral. I like the fact that Lane has this chain and it just goes like flying into the crowd. Oh yeah,
yeah.
Lance Russell says that he set the Olympic record for chain throw or something.
Yes, yes.
30 feet in the air and 30 rows deep.
That was weird because he pulls the chain out and he doesn't even get to use it at all.
I know. That was like, yeah, I kind of like that wrinkle. So as one would expect, the big bone gets involved. Stan Lane gets hit by the Moondog's big bone, and he's all bloody. So he plays the face in peril. Mm-hmm. Oh, Steve Kern was great in like trying to save Stan Lane just throughout that whole period. Like he's like flying all over the place trying to attack Moondogs, mm-hmm. but like because there's two Moondogs and one of him, he can like beat up one Moondog and the other Moondog's kicking Lane's ass, and he's gotta go fight the other Moondog, and like god damn it, that Moondog kicks Lane's ass. It's great. Kern is just I think Kern's probably he's probably the best in this match, even as a Stan Lane fan.
Right.
And then so finally Lane gets his knees up on a splash. He teases going to the wrong corner, but then he makes it to Kern. And Kern just tees off on the Moondogs. So he's biting and clawing at him until one of them bleeds, which was, like, really intense. Basically, you know, he's looking, you know, obviously the goal is to injure your opponent so much they have to go to the hospital. So that's basically what he's trying to do. He's trying to, like, open up such a nasty gash that he's going to send this Moondog to the hospital. But in the chaos, and this is what actually really makes the match, because I totally expected a sucky finish to this match. Like, the whole time I'm watching, I'm like, oh, this is so good, but they're going to have a shitty finish. They're going to have a shitty finish. And I'm usually a pretty optimistic person, but for whatever reason, I just had this stuck in my head that this finish was going to suck. And I was totally wrong. It was, like, the best finish ever. Mm-hmm. And Steve Kern gets his head trapped in the ropes. It's the Mick Foley spot.
Yeah.
And so, but the way he sells it is just like, he's like choking and he's kicking his legs. You really feel like, holy shit, that wasn't supposed to happen. And he could get like decapitated or he could like choke himself out. Mm-hmm. And then the Moondogs are attacking him at the same time. You're like, get the fuck away from him, dude. He's, you know, this is scary.
Yeah.
Stop attacking him, you assholes. And then Stan Lane, who the whole time Steve Kern's been trying to protect him, you know, he's, you know, it's now on him to save his partner. So he fends them off with a chair. Stan Lane actually calls for the bell to end the match because he knows his partner's in that much trouble. And he's in like when they the way the rope snapped.
Yeah.
Went let go was like terrifying. Like I thought like Kern was going to be decapitated. And he like was so then he just like fucking like slumps to the floor like his lifeless body.
Yeah.
And then you get this image of Stan Lane with the chair and the Moondogs in the ring and he's like standing over his lifeless partner. Oh my god. What a finish. And then they put, you know, they put Kern on the stretcher. It's professional wrestling. You know what happens. Moondogs topple the stretcher. Lane's pissed. Tees off on them. Just like, you know, everything up until the finish was like really good. And then the finish is just like fan fucking tastic.
Yeah. Yeah. All time memorable finish. Really great. Really gives, you know, gets over the sense, the feeling that this, you know, something really bad happened to Steve Kern, and it was just, yeah, it was crazy. I love this match. I didn't mention it was May 2nd, 1983 was this match. Another just crazy all-out brawl at the beginning, and blood right away. Lane is busted open very early, and you know it's out of control. The vibe of that being out of control is throughout the whole match. And I didn't notice that Lane had called for the bell.
He asked Jerry Calhoun to call for the bell.
Okay.
He's hollering for it. Yeah.
Right. See, that makes sense. Not that it wasn't like a spot that, you know, didn't warrant the bell being rung, because it was. It does, like Marty, you know, described, it was, you know, you have to see this, how they're just, they're pulling at Curran's legs as he's stuck in the ropes, basically being hung. Yeah, so the post-match, you know, just takes it to another level. Very wild feeling to it all. And yeah, it's crazy. Great match. Definitely this is one that people need to see. And the following match between these two, about a month later, just over a month later, June 13th, 1983, is just equally as crazy and in a totally different way than the previous match. And I didn't mention this before, but the Fabs come out to Everybody Wants You by Billy Squire.
Which that song is awesome.
That is an awesome song. Like the opening, the chords are great. You know, you can't hear it that great on the footage, so I had to get that off YouTube and then listen to it a few times after watching these matches.
Billy Squire is super underrated, like at least 5 like amazing songs, probably like 10.
Yeah, like, you would know more than I do.
Yeah,
but this is a great song, and it's perfect for the time, perfect for the Fabulous Ones gimmick.
You take attention in loneliness and alcohol is like one of the all-time great lyrics. That's from that song.
Yeah, it's a great one. So yeah, that's blaring in the background as they storm the ring, and then it's just another crazy brawl right from the get-go. Marty, what did you think of this encounter?
Yo, this is what I think of when I said originally, you know, I was going to say like ECW but done better. Like, this was, like, the best possible version of the Public Enemy versus the Gangstas. Like, it was just, like, total, like, just so awesome. Like, there's no, like, real way to recap it. It's just, like, two teams that just hate each other, just using every piece of furniture that wasn't nailed down to attack each other with it. Like, they were throwing friggin' tables at each other. They were like I love when people just hurl tables. They just hurl. And it's not these, like the 90s tables. These are like legitimate, like
Real
just going tables. At each other. They got the ring bells involved. The ring bell is gigantic.
Yes,
it looks like a friggin' trophy.
Yeah,
you know, they like break down the tables. They like, and then they got the leg of the table and they're swinging at them. It all ended up in the ring. They're beating the living shit out of each other. I think the match got thrown out in like 2 minutes.
Yeah, 2 minutes. DQ. Yeah. Jerry Calhoun, the referee, was knocked down immediately.
But they brawled for like another 8.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a full 10-minute brawl.
Yeah.
It's just like this bloody violent fight. I don't know. It is like one of the all-time best like barroom brawl like simulations. Like, this really felt like having... Actually, I saw a barroom brawl recently.
All right.
I caused one. The one thing I've never understood is... So, I'm not a person who's ever fallen in love at first sight.
All right.
And so, like, you know, I've never understood these men who, like, see these women and, like, in 10 minutes decide, well, I fucking love her. Like, chill out, dude. You just met her. Anyways, so this chick, she's dancing with me. Dude pulls her away. No big deal. She doesn't like him. She likes me. She literally willfully comes over to dance with me. Like, I didn't do anything, you know. And she's, like, dancing with me. And then, like, 30 minutes later, he's, like, shoving me. And then I'm a regular at this club. So one of the guys I know is, like, six. This isn't a bouncer. This is just a regular dude I know. He's like 6'3", 250 pounds, and he just freaking charges this dude, knocks him over, and I'm just like, well, I need to get the fuck out of here. So I got the girl, her friends, and I'm leaving, right? And I'm like headed for the door, and I look behind me, and it's just this insane freaking barroom brawl.
And it's like the Fabulous Ones versus the Moondogs. Like, people were getting shoved into tables. It's at this, like, Chinese restaurant that doubles as a nightclub. And there's this dragon thing. And this one guy got, like, shoved face first into this dragon statue. I was like, oh, shit, that looked like a heart. So anyways,
I love it. You're HBK in that situation, and you had Big Daddy Cool coming.
Exactly.
Clean things up.
I was wearing my Zubas too. I was wearing I think he was just pissed off. He's like, what is this? This motherfucker looks like a total tool with his zebra pen pants, and yet this chick likes him. I was like, I can't help who she likes. I want no trouble, mister. You know what actually started the fight, Kelly? Well, that started the fight, but you know what really got him hot? Was when I said, if you just get to know me, I think you'd really like me.
Awesome.
He did not like that comment.
That's great.
So anyways, yeah. So then I'm like, I run down the stairs. I see my favorite bouncer. His name's Big Daddy. And his actual first name is really Martin, so we're both Martins. And I was like, yeah, there's a fight going on upstairs. Marcus didn't start it, so don't throw him out. And I didn't tell him that I was involved at all.
That is amazing. Oh, very pro-wrestling. Yeah. And, yes, completely like the Fabs versus the Moondogs.
Yeah, I just put the two and two together. But, yeah, it was totally like the Fabs versus the Moondogs, but in real life.
Yeah. Well, I know I love this match too. I love how it was, you know, just so crazy that it stopped immediately because there's no control. The referee is knocked out, you know, within the first couple minutes, and then they just keep brawling, and you're not sure if it's ever going to end. It's similar to the concession stand brawl in a way, that it's all post match, and it's all, you're just wondering, are they ever going to stop brawling? It's like, what else can they do? Chairs, tables, the big bell, like you mentioned, just total chaos. And Lance Russell, who's awesome, one of my favorite wrestling commentators ever, is just almost, you can, you know, feel the disgust that he's going through, that he's feeling right now watching this, that it's like they can't even, you know, get their shit together to have a fucking wrestling match. They just have to destroy each other and destroy everything around them. So you can, you know, you just feel the disgust coming from him. Jerry Calhoun, the referee, is assaulted multiple times throughout this. He just keeps coming back, trying to stop it. And then again, he's knocked down. Everybody's bleeding, I believe, in this one. And then they brawl back to the dressing room. And it's, you know... What great booking. I mean, you give the fans a 2-minute match, but everybody is happy because the brawl afterwards is so awesome. And nothing is settled yet. It's still going. You know, there's still lots
to this day. It's still going.
Yeah, it's still going. Every couple months the brawl starts up again in Memphis. Yeah, this was, I believe, the first Fabs Moondogs match I ever saw, and this just got me hooked right away. Another classic. So we got two back-to-back classics between these teams.
Totally. I think this is, like, the best, like, non-finish. I guess it has a finish, but, like...
Right.
Like, the best just, like, pure brawl, not really with a finish type thing, like, that you could ever hope for.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a style that you could use in modern WWE every once in a while.
I know, totally. And you don't need a real finish. Like, everybody just looks awesome.
Yeah. You know, it prevents guys from having to do too many jobs and keeps feet going and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we fast forward now to January 1984. I'm not sure what happened in the intervening time. Like if the feud.
They just kept brawling. They finally made it to Los Angeles.
They finally, you know, that would be a great story. Like they just couldn't sanction these two guys anymore. There had been too many chaotic matches. So it took months and months before they finally got like the athletic commission to agree to let them wrestle again. I'm not an expert on Memphis wrestling. I love Memphis wrestling, but I'm by no means an expert, so I'm not sure what the storyline was, what was going on in like the regular TV week to week. But anyway, the next big match between the two was in January 84, and this is basically a no-holds-barred match. No referee inside the ring. There's a referee outside the ring. It's pretty much this is the blow-off, I guess you could say. Marty, what did you think of this one?
I like this one. It's very similar in vein to the match we just reviewed, only they kind of give you a finish.
Right.
But I felt like the finish was lame. So I'll talk about all the awesome stuff first, and then we can talk about the finish. The finish is just it's the 1980s, so it's just like a 1980s finish. So, I mean, as usual, you know, they start off all guns blazing. The Moondogs have a crutch for some reason. Is Jimmy Hart on crutches?
Russell, or maybe it was the other announcer, Randy Hales. But anyway, whoever. They mentioned that Hart came to the ring with crutches, which I'm assuming was just a work so that they could use the crutches or something. But anyway, yes, that's what happened.
Right. So then Lane gets the crutch and then hits one of the Moondogs in the kibbles and bits. Pretty good. So Lane is just wailing away with his crutch. And, you know, again, it's just that same type of brawl atmosphere. It's the weapons. It's the it's like a really good use of weapons. You know, like nowadays, weapons like suck.
I agree.
They just like it's hard to explain to people who don't watch 80s wrestling like why weapons like all of a sudden suck now. But like if you watch 80s wrestling, weapons are awesome, and they should still be awesome. But they just aren't any. They're just not awesome anymore.
Well, no,
it's because it lacks the hatred. Like there's no emotion behind the weapon shots.
No, they're just props. They don't feel dangerous at all. They're just. Yes, like we could talk about the recent Chris Jericho Dean Ambrose cage match,
I was there live.
Right, that's right.
Oh my God, what a boar fest! You know what saved that match for me?
Two guys
down the row were so fucking drunk. Okay, and the whole time they're screaming, "Chris, you can do better. Chris, get the tool." It will make you better. Chris, that's not how you win. They were really funny, actually.
But that's, you know, that's a prime example of, like, total, you know, sanitized use of weapons where nothing threatening at all.
Yeah. They did. By the end, the thumbtacks was, like, they actually kind of got the crowd back into it, building drama around the thumbtacks. But,
right.
God, the rest of that match, the belt shots were so lame. All the other, like, you know, weapons were...
Yeah, no. It was a horrible match. Horrible.
That was probably like... You know what's funny is I tweeted this at some point. I watched... That was the worst match I had ever seen live. And then I literally watched the best match I saw ever live, like, two matches later.
Right.
It was very strange.
Yeah, that's very I you know, I totally understand that.
And I'm really glad that AJ Styles Roman Reigns delivered. Otherwise, I would have driven 5 hours and spent like $600 on tickets, and I would have been pissed.
Yeah, no, you got your money's worth, bro.
Totally.
So back to Faz Moondogs.
Oh right. So yes, weapons are awesome in this match. And you know, there's like a really like kind of like sloppy spot, but it's like really cool because, you know, it's just an eye controller all. Like the Moondog, like, isn't really that athletic. So when he tries to take a backdrop onto the table, he freaking can't flip. So he kind of just takes this like weird header into the table, and it just like topples over. It's like, it's pretty sweet. Mm-hmm. So they throw the table in, you know, at some point that gets on. There's like people are getting really like thrown into that table hard too. And Kern gets a leather belt, and he's whipping people. There's a fucking pile driver. Now they're choking people. It was just like it was really good. My complaint is that the finish is just like they chase the Moondogs off with like one bone shot to the head.
Right.
It's just kind of like, you know, I don't know. I just wanted something a little bit more like, you know, final and climactic. But I understand, you know, it's the 1980s, and, you know, you don't want to kill the Moondogs off or anything. But, you know, just a little bit more, like, you know, beat up the Moondogs, stooging, and then running away would have been good.
Yeah. It makes sense, booking-wise, because that's how the feud started, was that they were assaulted with the bones on TV. So now you've come full circle where now the bones are being used on the Moondogs, and it also puts over the how dangerous the bones were, that even the Moondogs are scared of them and run away.
I guess that's true. I guess I just would have rather, like, you know, one of the Moondogs to get, like, knocked out and bloodied or something, and then it's like, you know.
Right. I can see they're definitely keeping the window open a crack for future matches, and maybe there were. I don't know.
That's true, too. Yeah.
Again, I'm not an expert on Memphis, so I don't know where things went from here. I do know the Fabs would leave the territory shortly after this and go and work in the AWA, and also I think in San Antonio and Southwestern too. So there was that, though they would be back, you know, by the summer of 84. And I think the Moondogs also were essentially done in Memphis at this point too. So no, there's a lot of stuff that, we're missing key bits of information here to really make a complete judgment on things. But yeah, the finish compared to, you know, what we saw before and then the ending here, it definitely, yeah, it wasn't.
It leaves something to be desired.
We're also modern fans and looking at things through a modern eye, where we get like these, you know, definitive finishes with the period, you know, where this is definitely the end. You know,
right.
We're used to that style of booking where, in the past, and in the 80s, things were a lot more vague and not as dramatic, perhaps, as far as, or definitive when it came to the end of feuds.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, all told, now we looked at four matches. They were all really good. For fans that are for listeners that are fans mostly of just WWE, WWF stuff, you got to see these matches. You know, we touched on it with the Jericho Ambrose use of weapons, and just in general the use of weapons in WWE. And this has been a problem for years, where nothing feels organic, nothing feels impulsive or anything when it comes to weapons. Everything is so manufactured and staged, and they got to set the tables up, set the ladders up, pull the chairs from under the ring or whatever, pull weapons from under the ring. Nothing feels real at all. It's all just so, I can't stand it. Any match in the WWE that uses weapons just totally, for me, just I check out mentally every time.
Yeah, I was so worried that Reigns Styles match was going to have weapons in it, because it was technically an Extreme Rules match. So thankful they didn't have weapons.
And then when they did sort of do, outside of the ring stuff, they went to the table where the...
Yeah, they used the tables. They used the pre-show table.
And that felt more like, you know, an impulsive thing. Like, that felt organic. So, yeah there is hope for the future. But anyway, we talk about stuff in the past.
Well, technically that match was in the past,
guys. Yes, it is in the past. That is right. But anyway, so in the 80s, our comfort zone. So now we're done with the Fabs Moondogs, but there's still more to come, folks. And we will take a quick break now, and you will listen to our fabulous ads for other shows on the PWO, PTBN network, and also the PTBN network of shows. And we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Okay, we're back, and to finish things off, we are going to look at a couple tag matches involving the new Fabulous Ones, who were Tommy Rich, famous for his run in Atlanta and Georgia earlier in the 80s, Wildfire, one of the top baby faces at the time, and Eddie Gilbert back again. Now becoming more the Eddie Gilbert you would recognize with the beard and getting a bit more experienced now and more mature. This is interesting stuff. So I mentioned before we went on break that the Fabs had left the territory, so they were gone at this point. I guess the gimmick was that they needed a new Fabulous Ones. Well, before I continue though, yeah, the Fabs got over like super hot, you know, super crazy. They originally, I think, were only, supposed to be, or well, the original idea, I read this somewhere, today, was that they would get together, feud with the New York Dolls, and then turn heel and feud with Lawler and Dundee. But they ended up getting so over and drawing like a new audience to the shows, drawing all the women that came and just, you know, it was like a rock concert type atmosphere, that they kept them going as baby faces and kept going with them. So, you know, keep going with a hot thing.
And exactly.
So here we have the new Fabulous Ones. I always thought it was strange that, you know, it was that Tommy Rich was one half of them. It seemed like, for me, like a step down for him, considering he was like the king of Georgia wrestling, one of the
world champion.
Yeah, briefly the NWA world champion, one of the top stars in wrestling in the early 80s, and now he's part of a knockoff of a popular team. Seems kind of strange to me. I don't know the whole story, or I really don't know the story at all between. Or what happened, why Rich is now in Memphis and what's going on exactly. But, you know, they have the same tights as the Fabulous Ones. They're basically continuing with the gimmick essentially here. And, but they're great. I mean, Tommy Rich was awesome. Eddie Gilbert was awesome. And the team they're going against is the Pretty Young Things, the PYTs, very interesting tag team. First, we have Norvell Austin, who I mentioned earlier in my little history of Memphis tag teams that he was part of a team with Smutnik or Monroe in the early
70s. So how old was Norvell at this point? He must have been old, right?
Yeah, he must have been mid to late 30s, I would guess. He was also part of the original Midnight Express team.
That's true. Yeah.
From the late 70s, which was a trio with him, Dennis Condrey, and Randy Rose. in, I want to say, was it Continental or Southeastern?
It was in, like, Alabama or East Tennessee or something.
Yeah, and also, like, the other Tennessee, or, well, there's several Tennessee promotions, actually, but the when they split from Nick Gulas and Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler went on their own, there was Mid-America with Gulas still. I think that may have been where they were the original Midnighters.
I think you were right the first time. I feel like they were in Alabama.
Right. Yeah, that whole part of the United States territorial map is confusing to me. And it's very intertwined. There's a lot of crossover with the promoters there.
Yeah. Well, you could listen to Exile on Bad Street.
Yes.
And their Continental Championship Wrestling, three parts.
Right.
I actually listened to parts one and three. It is very good.
Okay, so you skipped two for some reason.
Yeah, I skipped two because it didn't download properly. So I was like, screw it. I'm just going to listen to three. Right. You know, you talk about this being like beneath Tommy Rich or Step Down. He spends like all 85 in Alabama in Continental Wrestling. And not to knock on Continental Wrestling, I mean, Chris Nellner and Bo James do a great job of explaining how awesome Continental is, but it ain't exactly, you know, the WWF either. So right. Tommy Rich was slumming it in Alabama the following year. So
yeah, not the WWF. It wasn't the Carolinas. It wasn't the AWA. It wasn't a lot of.
Yeah, it wasn't even
world class. Yeah, Mid-South.
Yeah. Right. It was like it's like you know, one step above independent wrestling, basically.
So. Anyway, and then Norval Austin's partner is here. He's referred to as Stagger Lee.
Yes, I noticed that, but it's not because they confused him for the. It's not because all black people look the same, and the guy thought it was Junkyard Dog. But I guess like at one point, Coco Ware did go by Stagger Lee, and I think he was just confused which of the many Coco Ware gimmicks he was using at the time.
Right. Well, the history of Coco Ware or Coco Beware, as he would be known. In the WWF later in the 80s in Memphis was basically he was Coco Ware first and then he became Sweet Brown Sugar.
I love that name.
Yes, which is an awesome name. And there's an awesome match between him and Bill Dundee in a scaffold match.
I reviewed that match recently.
Yeah.
It is the best scaffold match of all time. Well, I guess I haven't seen Chicky Starr versus Invader 3.
I've seen that, and no, Dundee and Sweet Brown Sugar is better. It's awesome.
Oh.
Best okay. 2 out of 3 falls.
Yes.
And to put over a fellow podcaster, my friend Travis, who I grew up with in Calgary and who lives in Vancouver, a few weeks ago we had a all-day wrestling marathon at his place that he dubbed Ultima Caucho, and one of the matches we had on, actually he was recording his own podcast. His podcast is Lucha Afterground, where they talk about the latest season of Lucha Underground. And while they were recording that or the episode, I was watching in the background Dundee versus Sweet Brown Sugar from Memphis, the best 2 out of 3 falls scaffold match. And it's great. I think it's the best 2 out of 3 falls stip that makes it so awesome.
Because
you have to beat the guy off the scaffold, and he, bam, hits the mat. But then he has to climb back up again and do another fall. And it's so dramatic that way.
Okay. I actually felt the opposite way, but okay. Yeah,
really?
I'm glad you did. Yeah. Yeah, no, I didn't. I actually thought 2 out of 3 falls, I actually heard it.
Oh, really? I thought that
because I thought the whole match. Right, I can tell that. And yeah, I think you made a good point. My reason why I didn't like it as a 2 out of 3 falls match is, to me, the scaffold is so dangerous. So if you fall, that should be it. That should be the finish. Like, the fact that they got back up kind of, like, killed the scaffold for me.
Well, this is tag teams back again, not singles wrestling back again. So we'll leave it at that.
I always prefer people to have a positive opinion of a match, so I am not I'm not going to not say my opinion, but I'd rather people be positive about a match.
Okay. So yeah. Anyway, as Sweet Brown Sugar, he had that awesome scaffold match. And then right. he lost a Loser Leaves Town match. And so he had to come back under a mask and was Stagger Lee at that point. And I guess this was kind of a ripoff of Junkyard Dog and Mid-South earlier, I think in 82. Junkyard Dog and Mid-South lost a Loser Leaves Town match, and he came back as Stagger Lee.
And, from out of town.
Yeah. So they had this, and this is going on at almost the same time. But by the time we get to this match in May of 84, he doesn't have the mask anymore, but he's still called Stagger Lee. And
he is. I thought the announcer just screwed up.
He, at times he's also referred to as Coco Ware, but they kind of go back and forth here. Anyway, so here we go. This match is Falls Count Anywhere, and it's pretty amazing as well. Marty, what did you think of it?
Yeah, I thought this was incredible. I thought this is just like, it's pretty much almost as good as the Fabulous Ones and the Moondogs. It's just like, it's a balls to the wall, you know, slugfest. I thought Gilbert and Coco were just like off the charts great. Like, Coco Ware versus Eddie Gilbert singles match is just like, from 1984, is like my dream match. Like, they had like insane chemistry. You know, Gilbert was just like tackling the PYTs like at every turn, just was pissed and just would just like lunge at him. And then Coco breaking the cane over Gilbert's back, jabbing him in the throat. Coco Ware is like friggin' awesome in like every match you see him in throughout this period. Like, the other thing people love to say about Sweet Brown Sugar is that he's actually Bobby Eaton's best tag team partner, which is like, I think it's hyperbole. I think people are just saying it to kind of make a point. Mm-hmm. But like, when you watch, I watched him and Bobby Eaton versus Dutch Mantel and somebody who I can't remember. And, but like, it was like two Bobby Eatons were in the ring, you know? Coco Ware is just like this offensive dynamo, and he's just like moving around. He bumps great. He's just, you know, he's a really great wrestler. He's got the Flair match in 85, which is incredible too. So, Rich was a great, hot tag. This is actually good arena brawling. Like, I hate arena brawling. I think everybody does at this point, but like, this is like really good arena brawling because they make use of like the platform in the back.
Yes.
And you really feel like, yeah, you just don't know what's going to happen. You feel like someone's going to like, you know, fall off that thing, and then Rich just, it's totally out of control, and Rich just gets so pissed he finally just slugs the ref. And I watched this match a couple months ago. I actually wrote, I booed in my chair because I wanted it to keep going. I was like, boo. But yeah, no, and I do have a good point. It's Falls Count Anywhere, so, you know, but there'd be a winner, man. But seriously, like, really good brawl. Like, just, you know, all-time great brawl. Definitely worth seeing. Great Coco Ware and Eddie Gilbert performance.
Yeah, I agree that, you know, it would have been nice to have a finish. I really love this match. Wild brawl, inside and outside the ring. Tons of brutal violence. You mentioned the cane. That seemed very dangerous and violent. Tommy Rich was an awesome House of Fire. And then, when they got up on the stage, which they mentioned on commentary was used for concerts that they would have at the arena. So this felt like, you know, a match that had gone to another level, that they were now literally on this stage that, you know, you could only access for the most violent matches. And so it, you know, as soon as they got up on that stage, I felt like this was like, you know, the ultimate culmination of a violent match where now anything could happen. They're on this stage, you know, it's unexplored territory. So that really just, for me, that put this match on another level. And at the same time, like at first it was Rich and Austin on the stage, and Gilbert and Coker are brawling in the seats. So it was just simultaneous violence and out of control stuff. But yes, no finish, which is, you know, considering it was Falls Count Anywhere, you know, you shouldn't have a no finish for that type of match. But again, this is the 80s. Definitive finishes were, rare. There was always the idea that you had to book to the next show, keep things going. You didn't want to, end things and prevent a chance at making more money off of something too soon, I guess. And so, yeah, who knows? They must have had something else planned for these guys. I don't know. But this was really cool.
The original Fabs were back by the next month, and we're wrestling the PYTs.
Yes, that's true.
So you don't want the PYTs versus Fabs to, you want some heat left on the PYTs.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, heels basically only lost definitively if they were leaving the territory. And even at that, and even then, that they sometimes didn't. So it was very rare for a definitive loss, even in a match like this. So now we're continuing with the new Fabs, and we're on to June 25th now, 84, for a Tennessee street fight between the new Fabs and Phil Hickerson and the Spoiler. Now, Hickerson was a longtime Memphis guy, Southern dude, pretty good wrestler. Teamed with Dennis Condrey, who would be, of course, half of the Midnight Express.
Would you say he's some dude from down south?
Yeah, some dude from down south. Later in the 80s, at the very end of the 80s, actually, he would be known as, he would have this transformation into a Japanese wrestler, and he'd become P.Y. Chu Hai.
I heard about that.
Very end of, actually, it was when World Class and Memphis essentially merged at the end of the 80s. And it was at the end.
What was his theme song? Was it, I think I'm turning Japanese?
I don't think it was, but it may have been. It should have been.
It really should have been.
Yeah. But yeah, he was a key individual in the end. They did a big angle where World Class essentially ceased to exist, and the promotion became USWA going forward. He feuded with Eric Embry. That was very famous.
Yes, Eric Embry, yeah.
And the Spoiler here is not Don Jardine.
He isn't. I was going to ask you if he was.
No. Who was the original Spoiler and the Spoiler. Memphis was famous for using mass gimmicks, but not using the wrestler most famous, most associated with that gimmick. So they did it with the Spoiler. They would do it with the Assassins later, where they would bring in an Assassins team that wasn't Jody Hamilton and Randy Colley or whoever the other Assassin was at the time. So this was par for the course for Memphis. But anyway, we get another awesome match, another total crazy brawl, which is the theme of the evening.
Just like, it is definitely the theme of the evening. This is no technical wizardry. It's just fists. It's really awesome bloody brawl. Hickerson and Spoiler are dressed in their janitor blues, baby, for this street fight. intense. Like, this is what I picture, like, a street fight, what it should be. Mm-hmm. Right off the bat, so Gilbert tries to grab a mic stand to help Tommy out, but he ends up falling. So Rich finally turns the tide on Hickerson by driving his head into the table, and Hickerson bleeds buckets. It's just like, there's a pool of his own blood on the floor. Mm-hmm. Gilbert is obsessed with the mask of the Spoiler. Spoiler gets his boot and clobbers him, so now Gilbert's bleeding. Spoiler wallops Tommy with his boot, but it takes three shots before it registers, because Tommy Rich, motherfucker, is in the zone. So Rich takes his boots off, and he starts going to town. I thought this was when Tommy Rich really shined. Like, if the last match was like Eddie Gilbert, moment in the sun, like, this is the Tommy Rich time, baby. Mm-hmm. Eddie Gilbert ends up pile driving the Spoiler on the outside, and, like, I just thought that was nasty. Rich ends up wearing this loaded mask and then headbutts like the, you know, almost, you know, unconscious Hickerson because he's lost so much blood for the win.
Yeah.
Loved it. Just like super fast paced. Just like they, I was what, sub, it's sub 10 minutes. It's like what, 7 minutes?
Yeah.
And it's just like totally action packed, balls to the wall, and totally what a street fight should be. And it's got a finish, baby. So that puts it in classic territory.
Yeah, and that's a good way to end it. This is the last match we're going to look at, and we finally get a finish after going through all those other matches. Yes, we planned it this way. Not really. Yeah, this is great. I love, you know, a street fight where everybody's wearing regular clothes. And, of course, the baby faces would always wear blue jeans and cowboy boots and a white T-shirt so you could see blood on it. And Tommy Rich is busted open within, like, 30 seconds.
Basically. Yeah.
And he's selling it really great. You could see him where he's, like squeezing the blood out of his forehead, that pose that wrestlers get where they're trying to force the blood out.
Yeah, they're trying to like pump all the blood to their forehead.
Yeah. So he's covered in blood. His shirt's covered in blood. Hickerson's just bleeding buckets. Tables are used again. Just a nonstop brawl. Pile driver on the cement by Gilbert.
That was insane.
On the spoiler, which is in Memphis, you know, the pile driver is famously banned.
Right.
You could only use it in these kind of contexts. So that means even more for the Memphis crowd. And then the finish, which I'm assuming played on some sort of angle. Where Rich put on a mask, and it was a loaded mask, and headbutts Hickerson.
I would imagine the spoiler had a loaded mask.
Yeah, exactly. Just total crazy mayhem. This is Memphis wrestling right here. Fittingly, a Tennessee street fight. And a great way to end it. Just a blood-soaked tag team's back again today.
It was a blood-soaked tag team's back again.
Yeah. I love this stuff. I love Memphis wrestling so much.
I love blood.
I'm a blood fan too. You know, and it's there's something about it. It just adds to the drama of a match. And we've seen it throughout tonight's selection of matches. So here we go. Marty, what was your favorite match that we watched?
All right, so it's very close. I gave two matches of these seven, 4.5 stars, which is a pretty big deal.
That is
a pretty high rating. So the two matches I gave 4.5 stars was the one we just talked about, Rich and Gilbert versus Hickerson in the spoiler. And the other one was the Fabs versus Moondogs, the stretcher match. Going with the stretcher match on the strength of that finish.
Yeah.
Because I think that's one of the all-time great finishes.
Yeah, I agree. Like, the finish of that, even though... Yeah, I mean, that was
That's a clear definitive finish.
Yeah, that's a definitive finish. It's not a pinfall, but that was... I mean, the rules were it was a stretcher match, so you weren't
going to
have a pinfall. So, yeah, that was a definitive finish.
Yeah.
And for a babyface team going down like that, that's pretty hardcore, so...
It was. It was a pretty hardcore spot.
Of all the matches we watched, that closing sequence with Kern trapped in the ropes is the one thing that you'll remember forever.
It is. No doubt about it.
I'm going to go with the follow-up to the stretcher match, the June 13th brawl that was thrown out after 2 minutes and then they brawled.
That's a really good match. I actually, even without a finish... I gave it 4.25, which is, you know, like, you know, I felt like it's as high as I can go. But yeah, I thought that was incredible. I thought they did a really fucking good job with that match.
Yeah, I mean, I love the stretcher match too. It's really close between those two. The final two matches we saw with the New Fabulous Ones, they were fresh to me. I'd never seen them before, and I really liked them too. And the Falls Count Anywhere with the concert stage getting used really excited me.
These were like really good matches.
Yeah, these were choice cuts. Marty and I, we have a thread or a PM thread thing on Facebook where we talk about.
We're Facebook official, baby.
Yeah, so Marty picked these matches, and I joke like, you know, I've made him watch a lot of crap from the WWF.
So. Still haven't made me watch Hillbilly Jim yet.
Yeah, we've still avoided Hillbilly Jim, and we're running out of time, like I've said before. But yeah. it was about time we watched some choice cuts, complete from start to finish choice cuts. Every match, even the first Fabs Moondogs match, was good, and there wasn't like everything was amazing here. So, yeah, thank you, Marty. You took me on a wild, wild Memphis ride.
There's no other way to enjoy Memphis than wild and bloody.
Exactly, and I believe we'll definitely revisit Memphis in the future. There's
there's some other ones that I left off. There's a Jerry Lawler and Dutch Mantel versus Bill Dundee and Buddy Landell.
Right, that's a Texas death match, correct?
No, I don't think we have that.
Oh, okay.
We just have like the match from the week before.
Right.
That's really friggin' good. And there's a couple other tag matches that I kept in my back pocket.
Well, and yeah, like we did a whole show on Memphis wrestling and didn't even look at a Jerry Lawler match. So
this is true, and Jerry Lawler is incredible.
Yes, very incredible. Yes. So there's tons of possibilities for the future. Next time, though, I think, Marty, we have to return to the North, return to the WWF.
I think I'm okay with that. And I think it's been a while. Oh, yeah. Is the next show going to be in 1988, or do we have 1987 left to cover?
The next show is 1988. Yes, it's a new year.
Yes, it's 1988. Okay, we made it through 1987.
Yep. So we'll have stuff from January, February, March. Probably, let's do the months leading up to WrestleMania 4. And I know I've already checked around and found some potential matches.
All right.
So we're going to look at the Jumping Bomb Angels again. Of course, if we're looking at the Jumping Bomb Angels, we're looking at the Glamour Girls.
Judy Martin's Kick of Fear.
Yes, and a match between them from the first inaugural Royal Rumble from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada.
Go Tigers.
Tiger Cats.
Ah, damn it. I was trying to, you know, like show that an American knew something about Canada. No,
that's what Tigers are called in Canada. And also some goodness with Hulk Hogan and Bam Bam Bigelow.
Hogan and Sir Oliver Humperdinck.
Yes. What a combo. What a team. So, yes, we'll be back to the North, back to the WWF, and we're into 1988. And, yes, look out for that, fans. So, for Marty Sleaze, this is Kelly Nelson. Whoop, there it is.
Two.
So, wait. Just two. Sweet.
For life.
Two.